This is the EarlyHarvard.com podcast on The Harvard Slavery Report, founded on half-truths and distorted history. Our commitment to truth means that we must embrace it, even when it makes us uncomfortable or causes us pain. These are the words of Harvard's current president, Lawrence Bacow, in presenting the university's April 22 report titled Harvard and the Legacy of Slavery. However, after a careful review of this report, one must question just how deep the university's commitment to the truth really is. While the report and accompanying video do document some painful historical truths and rightly shine a light on them, the report at least mixes those in with numerous half-truths, historical sleights of hand, extreme bias, and in some cases, what can only be seen as anti-Christian bigotry. It goes way beyond history. Veritas is Harvard's motto. It is Latin for the truth. Veritas also stands for the process of searching for and finding the truth. What emerges from a careful reading of this report is its commitment to an ideological agenda, a woke agenda, rather than an honest historical assessment. Slavery is a subject that has not been explored sufficiently by past historians of Harvard's history. The contributions that the report does make are completely interspersed with many deeply flawed assumptions. It is neither balanced nor nuanced, and in the end, comes off as propaganda, which unfortunately renders much of the project suspect. The report's authors see slavery even when the historical record is vague. It is the proverbial hammer that sees everything it encounters as a nail. It is mostly an example of extreme overreach in service to a worldview of historical revisionism. Harvard's report on slavery is a poor stepchild of the deeply flawed 1619 Project, promoted by the New York Times and propagandists on the left who have sought to reinterpret America's founding not as a beacon of liberty, but as a, quote, slavocracy, end quote. 1619 Project critic Mary Graybar has termed the 1619 Project a polemic steeped in ideology. She asserts that the sins of commission and omission in the project go deep and range wide, and that its case for, quote, replacing 1776 with 1619 as the true founding of America is built up with half-truths and untruths, end quote. She added, quote, the 1619 Project reframes American history by twisting evidence and leaving out exculpatory facts, end quote. The Harvard Report on Slavery does much the same. The report does not measure up to what President Bacow claimed it was when he described it thusly, quote, my hope, he said, is that those who succeed us will look back and judge us to have been champions of Veritas, to have stood for truth, and to have acted upon it, end quote. No, not by a long shot. Sadly, rather than focusing on the most significant issues that are well documented and need to be shared, the report's authors seemed primarily interested in a particular narrative, a narrative filled with distortions and half-truths. The report's agenda-driven narrative has already been breathlessly disseminated by a lapdog media eager to reframe American history. The Washington Post asserted on April 22, 2022, soon after the report's release, that, quote, it represents a landmark acknowledgement from one of the world's most prestigious universities of the breadth of its entanglement with slavery, white supremacy, and racial injustice for centuries after its 1636 founding, end quote. Harvard's virtue signaling has found its mark. So, where to begin? Well, let's start with the 2016 statement of Harvard's former president, Drew Gilpin Faust, who wrote that, quote, Harvard was directly complicit in America's system of racial bondage from the college's earliest days in the 17th century until slavery in Massachusetts ended in 1783, end quote. To be clear, Harvard was not, quote, directly complicit in America's system of racial bondage from the college's earliest days. There were Indian captives from the colonists' wars with the Indians, some of whom were sold into slavery during this period, following the 1636 to 37 Pequot War. We will explore that part of the report in a future podcast. But while the Harvard report, unlike the video that accompanies it, often conflates African and Indian servitude, that is not even what Faust was referring to in her editorial, since in the very sentence before this, she was specifically referring to the, quote, presence and contributions of people of African descent at Harvard, end quote. But with this 2016 editorial, Faust helped lay the foundation for what was to follow some 6 years later, culminating in the official report on slavery that has the imprimatur of the president and fellows of Harvard College, that is, the Harvard Corporation. Faust was also a sponsor of an earlier, more balanced 2011 report titled Harvard and Slavery, Seeking a Forgotten History, by faculty members Sven Beckhardt, Catherine Stevens, and the students of the Harvard and Slavery Research Seminar. That report, which Beckhardt described in 2011 as a, quote, quest that began with fears of finding nothing, ended with a new question. How was it that the university had failed for so long to engage with this elephantine, that is enormous, aspect of its history? End quote. It's a fair question. It's not that anyone was hiding it. It's just that no one previously had compiled everything together in one place. Beckhardt and his students in 2011 rightly sought that forgotten history, and they found it. Former President Faust gave it her support and wider legitimacy. But somewhere along the way, in the intervening 11 years since that report first appeared, that forgotten part of Harvard's history has now been transformed into something else. And that is a single reductionist racial narrative on Harvard's past, with intimations and accusations throughout of white supremacy, exploitation, Marxian-style explanations of economic motives, and not-so-subtle anti-Christian bigotry. So while former President Faust is to be commended for urging forward this initial process and in helping uncover this forgotten history, she should not be commended for making the kind of hyperbolic and unsubstantiating conclusions that she did in 2016, the fruit of which we now see in this 2022 report. Beckhardt himself also seems to have abandoned whatever balance was reflected in the 2011 report. Now he says, quote, what I think is the most powerful finding is that slavery permeated almost everything about Harvard's early history, end quote. That is ludicrous, but it does demonstrate just how far the authors of this report have strayed from the original mission. We will now get into the heart of the matter. To begin with, who was the first supposed enslaved person at Harvard? According to the report, quote, the enslaved man known as the Moor, who could have arrived aboard the Desire, was the first of many enslaved people who would serve Harvard students in the colonial era, end quote. Elsewhere, the report states, quote, it is possible that the man known to us only as the Moor, who was enslaved by Harvard's first schoolmaster, Nathaniel Eaton, and in that capacity served Harvard's earliest students, arrived in New England aboard the ship Desire, end quote. This is very important to understand because woke Harvard is now trying to build its entire early history and by extension the origin of all American higher education on the premise that slavery was an integral part of the institution from its very beginnings. Let me say emphatically, this is not true. Now regarding the man known as the Moor, while it is true, perhaps even likely given his moniker, that he may have arrived in New England as an enslaved person, we do not know that for a fact. We certainly do not know whether or not he arrived on the ship Desire. He may have or he may not have. It's also true that some past historians of Harvard, like Samuel Eliot Morison, assumed, without thinking it through very much, that the Moor probably or apparently was a slave. For more background on that, I direct you to the more extensive documentation in the PDF that accompanies this podcast at earlyharvard.com. We'll get into more of the details in a moment. Now, while I believe there are some serious questions to raise about the Moor's status, the historical record does seem quite clear when it comes to Emanuel Downing, brother-in-law of the governor of the Massachusetts at the time, John Winthrop Sr., in which he wrote in 1645 of, quote, the ships that shall bring Moors. This was clearly a reference to Negro slaves. Downing added, quote, and I suppose you know very well how we shall maintain 20 Moors cheaper than one English servant, end quote. Downing was writing to Winthrop about wanting to exchange Indian captives from the Pequot War for African slaves. So it's very clear that some form of slavery existed in New England at this time. Thus, while it's very possible that the Moor did originally arrive in the New World as a slave, I believe it is also very unlikely that he was in an enslaved status when he lived and worked at Harvard. To explain why I think this is the case, and to walk our way through this, let's go back to the ship Desire, which is mentioned numerous times in the report. The Desire was a ship commanded by an English privateer named William Pierce from Massachusetts Bay Colony. Pierce sold into slavery in the Caribbean 17 Pequot Indians, 15 boys and 2 women, who'd been taken captive during the Pequot War. Pierce thus pioneered what became the New England slave trade, which in its early years often included this type of exchange of Indian war captives for African slaves in the Caribbean. So was the Moor one of these slaves brought to Massachusetts? Possibly. On the other hand, one recent history on slavery in New England states, regarding the 1638 arrival of the Desire, quote, "They were most likely people of African descent in the region before this nefarious swap." Thus the Moor, whoever he was, may have arrived in Massachusetts at another time and by another means than coming aboard the slave ship Desire. But let's stipulate that he was aboard the Desire and was perhaps purchased by the soon-to-be Harvard schoolmaster Nathaniel Eaton at the dock in Boston after that ship arrived. To see how this scenario plays out, you need to go to the PDF. The Eatons had not yet moved to Cambridge, classes at Harvard had not yet begun, and probably would not begin for at least the next 4 or 5 months. Was he perhaps purchased by the college on Eaton's behalf? Possibly, but extremely unlikely. While it's true that we don't have complete records from that time, common sense tells us that a slave who was considered part of Harvard College property would have eventually been recorded somewhere. There is no such record. The main point is this. There's no specific evidence that the Moor was in an enslaved status while he served at Harvard. In fact, what little we do know about him actually argues very strongly against that idea. The sum total of what we do know is based on the handwritten transcript of notes from a trial covering the testimony of one Mistress Eaton, Nathaniel Eaton's hapless wife. And that transcript itself does not really focus on the Moor, but rather on how poorly Harvard's first students were treated and fed, as well as the fact that they were physically abused with punishments. In her statement to the court, Mrs. Eaton sought to counter the very damaging testimony that had just been shared with the magistrates by some of the Harvard students and apparently other witnesses. The PDF goes into this quite extensively. The picture painted by the transcript is one of the servants apparently ruling the roost over the students under Eaton's iron hand. Presumably the Moor was part of that system, which seems to have been a hierarchy of sadism, with the Eatons at the top, the servants as their enforcers in the middle, and Harvard students at the bottom. The picture is not one of students having servants or a slave at their beck and call. Rather, the students appear to have been daily supplicants. This is very important to understand. It is a picture completely contrary to the picture that the Harvard Slavery Report tries to convey, which is one of entitled, white, colonial students being waited on by at least one person of color who was supposedly a slave. And while it's true that, through the centuries, Harvard has often had its issues with privilege, to ascribe this picture to the Eaton era is a completely unfair and distorted view. Mrs. Eaton next sought to counter previous testimony that Harvard students under her care had often been relegated to, quote, eating the Moor's crusts. Now, what did that mean? Well, to simply take the words at face value, it apparently meant that the Moor, the supposed slave, was fed prior to the students and was perhaps getting fresh bread, and that the students themselves were reduced to eating the crusts that he had left over. Or alternatively, one might interpret this to mean that the Moor was being fed bread crusts and the students also had to make do with only receiving bread crusts. But notice that these are still designated as the Moor's crusts, showing that he had them first, or got them first, and that the students got the leftovers. Again, this is evidence of hierarchy, with Harvard students at the bottom. The college at this time sounds more like a prison camp than a school, almost like something out of Dickens. To make matters worse, Mrs. Eaton next tried to counter additional testimony that Harvard students even had to share these bread crusts with the college pigs in a share and share alike arrangement. Truly disgusting. And yet Harvard wants to officially build its story of slavery at the college, starting with this whole revolting episode as its foundation. It is an absurd mangling of limited historical fact with an imaginary structure of white students allegedly lording it over a supposed slave when just the opposite appears to be the case. There's a lot more on this that the PDF goes into regarding food and drink and how the Moor received special positive treatment. Eaton himself was aptly called Master Eaton. He demanded absolute obedience. Students were apparently beaten at the slightest sign of disobedience. Morrison notes that sometimes the students were, quote, given 20 or 30 stripes at a time until they would confess what the master compelled them to, end quote. Eaton himself rarely confessed this at trial and was proud of it, He told the court that he had this rule, that he would not give over correcting till he had subdued the party to his will. Harvard College at this time truly exemplified the old joke, the beatings will continue until morale improves. But we need to back up a bit. Why was there a trial in the first place? How did this all come about? The trial where all of this terrible information came tumbling out was precipitated by an earlier event. That event involved Nathaniel Eaton's beating of another Nathaniel, an Englishman named Nathaniel Briscoe, who had been an applicant for a job at the college, the position of usher. Briscoe's story is covered at length in another podcast here at earlyharvard.com, the one that describes Eaton's reign of terror. Prior to this trial, Eaton had everyone hoodwinked. Eaton had Briscoe brought up on charges for pulling a knife on him. Everyone, except those on the inside, thought that Briscoe was in the wrong, that he was some sort of wild ruffian who had threatened Eaton. But then at the trial, it came out that Eaton himself had been the aggressor. He had beaten Briscoe possibly to within an inch of his life. The authorities were appalled. Eaton had used a walnut wood cudgel a yard long, big enough to have killed a horse. He reportedly hit Briscoe some 200 times with this massive cudgel while two of Eaton's servants held him down. Was the Moor, perhaps one of those two servants who held Briscoe down while he was being beaten by Eaton? We don't know, but the whole story was a nightmare. What is clear is that Harvard's first year as a working school during 1638 to 1639 was a house of horrors, a disaster of first proportions. It is ridiculous to use it as a measuring stick for anything. But none of this is captured in the report. Instead, we see the Moor prominently mentioned as the first person in the so-called, quote, list of human beings enslaved by prominent Harvard affiliates, end quote. Interestingly, the 2011 report was more nuanced. It did not assume that the Moor had been a slave. It stated simply, quote, if the Moor was indeed a slave, he was likely the first to be connected to Harvard, end quote. True enough. So here we have an interesting dilemma. In the 11 years since the 2011 report, has some new historical fact about the Moor been discovered by the Presidential Committee on Harvard and the Legacy of Slavery? Something that has transformed the nuanced statement of 2011 about the Moor possibly being a slave into becoming in 2022 an indisputable fact that he was? I think not. But I would challenge the Harvard Committee on Slavery and the Harvard Corporation, which has endorsed this report, to produce such a source, and I will happily withdraw my complaint. It would appear that the only thing separating the 2011 report from the 2022 report is Harvard's new agenda of wokeness and its sacrifice of truth on the altar of historical revisionism. This is doubly sad because it is so unnecessary. Well, to get back to the Moor, we never hear anything more about him. He disappears from the record, although we learn a lot about what happens to the Eatons after this, which you can read at length in the PDF. In applying logic and Occam's razor, it seems that whatever his original status was in coming to the New World, the Moor was no slave of the college and no family slave of the Eatons. In 1640, Henry Dunster, Harvard's first president, arrived in Cambridge and more or less rebuilt the college from scratch. There is no evidence that Dunster nor any of his early successors as president had slaves. Not until the time of Increase Mather, some 45 years later. In 2019, the Harvard Crimson published an article titled, But for the Grace of Henry Dunster, commenting on this period of Harvard's history. Quote, Eaton's tenure was a debacle. He not only mismanaged finances, but embezzled money from the school. With terrorized students, uncertain funding, and no leader, Harvard shut down for a year. That Harvard exists today is largely thanks to the work of Henry Dunster, who was appointed president in 1640, end quote. Dunster literally saved the day and saved what was left of Harvard College. Some might ask, how did a rogue like Eaton even get hired in the first place? Well, that would take another entire podcast to answer. But let me just say this, that within the Puritan world, Eaton, having been a student of William Ames, who lived from 1576 to 1633, came with the highest academic credentials. Ames, who died 5 years before these events took place, had been one of the most influential theologians of Puritanism. So that is the true history of Nathaniel Eaton in this awful period of Harvard's earliest history. But to leave all of this out in its report, to merely assert that the Moor was, quote, an enslaved human being, end quote, while he clearly enjoyed a status certainly equal to and apparently above that of Harvard students themselves at the time, is an absurdity. But the issue goes deeper than that. It goes to intent. The report might have skipped on to the Wadsworth and Holyoke eras, some 80 or 100 years later, in the 18th century, where the documentation is quite clear that some Harvard presidents did own slaves, some did serve on campus, and now, because of this renewed focus on slavery, we know many of their names, Titus, Venus, Bilha, and Juba. By doing so, the report would have had greater credibility and still gotten its message across. But the report did not do that, and the question is, why? The answer seems clear. The overall narrative would collapse if it did. Clearly, the goal was to tie the stench of slavery to Harvard's very beginnings, to its very origin as an institution. This is how woke ideology begins to corrupt everything it touches. Let me add one more thing. Like a lawyer arguing a case before a jury with Harvard's early history sitting in the dock, I have provided reasonable doubt that the Moor was a slave. But whether you are persuaded or not, the key point is that this short and awful Eaton era we've just discussed was an anomaly. Past historians of Harvard have covered it briefly but quickly moved on. Why? Because they were ashamed of it, embarrassed in fact, and it offered nothing of value to Harvard's later storied history. But the report makes no distinction here. There's no mention of Eaton being a complete scoundrel or any of this background. Instead, the report's authors went in search of certain facts while ignoring other facts. Now, it's absolutely true that later on there were slaves of African descent owned by a few specific individuals with Harvard connections prior to the 18th century. One of them was Thomas Danforth, who served as college treasurer from 1650 to 68, then as steward from 1668 to 82, and also during later years as an overseer. Danforth was also deputy governor of Massachusetts for 20 years. At some point in his life, Danforth acquired a personal slave whose name was Philip Failed, spelled F-F-E-I-L-D. But when and how Philip Failed became a slave in the Danforth household is not known. Danforth, in many respects, was a walking contradiction. As a leading colonial official, he was a fierce early champion for liberty and self-government in Massachusetts against royal encroachment from England, and yet he owned a slave. He persecuted the Quakers in Massachusetts, but he also opposed the Salem witch trials. Danforth died in 1699. There's no evidence of which I am aware that Philip Failed had any direct connection to the college. In his will, Danforth stated that, after his death, Philip should serve his son-in-law, Mr. Francis Foxcroft, for an additional 4 years, and then become a free man and also receive £10 and 40 acres of farmland around Cambridge. Then you also have Cotton and Increase Mather. Both of them did own slaves, for which there is a lot of documentation. But the Mathers are a complex case, both father and son. In the case of Cotton Mather, I would direct you to a book by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Kenneth Silverman's 1984 biography titled The Life and Times of Cotton Mather. Harvard scholar Sack van Berkovich, in an endorsement called the book A Model of Historical Scholarship, remarkable both for its enormous learning and for its clarity of analysis. Those are attributes that one can certainly not ascribe to the slavery report. Increase Mather became acting president of Harvard in 1685. He was the first example that we know of a president of Harvard who definitely owned slaves. A study of the Mathers, their relationships to Harvard and the New England community, their households, and how they treated their slaves and servants could easily take up another entire podcast. The fact that these individuals owned slaves should be criticized, but some background as to who they were and how they ran their households should also have been provided. Meanwhile, there is no evidence, so far as I know, that these personal family slaves were ever resident on campus or served any Harvard students during the 45 years from 1640 to 1685, and even after 1685, we really need to wait until the early 18th century and the presidencies of Presidents Benjamin Wadsworth from the period 1725 to 1737 and Edward Holyoke from 1737 to 1769 to get to a point where we know for sure that there were enslaved people working on campus. It would have been far better for the Harvard Report to have focused on a tragic century of slavery from roughly the 1680s until 1783 when slavery was abolished, instead of trying to place the entire early years of the institution under a cloud. The report's authors should also not have completely entangled the story of Pequot Indian War captives with the story of African slaves brought to New England. Yes, there were connections between the two groups as the slave trade developed, but the report lacks all context and makes no distinctions in that process. It simply conflates the two histories into one narrative with an apparent single purpose: to cast the New England Puritans and the generation of Harvard's founders in the worst possible light, and to make them out to be fundamentally racist and exploitative. Just as the 1619 Project was oriented to denounce America's entire early history as a slaveocracy, Harvard's report on slavery seeks to define Harvard's earliest history as being completely mired in the evils of slavery. To reduce Harvard's story to this is a disgrace. But this is another example of how woke ideology clouds the truth, the whole truth, in support of a particular agenda. Yes, Harvard's early history includes some painful episodes, to cite President Bacow's earlier statement. And let me emphasize, we need to look at those episodes and not shy away from them. But Harvard's story is also a story of glory in the midst of struggle and pain and contradiction. Unfortunately, when it comes to Harvard's early history, the slavery report represents primarily cherry-picked facts seen through the ideological lens of present-day wokeness. To the extent that it obscures the full story and clouds the search for full historical truth, it is anti-history. It is certainly not veritas. And that, in the end, is all we have. If our search for the truth is not honest and thorough and transparent, then we really have nothing at all. We will look at another example of distorted and shoddy history in the Harvard Slavery Report in our next podcast. This is A.J. Melnick for EarlyHarvard.com.